You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Nisa Ishikawa. Nisa, thanks so much for being with me today.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Nisa, so you're calling from London, of course, and I know you've traveled a lot or moved around. How is, just to give a snapshot of London in terms of the arts, and before we jump into your studio and process and practice, how are you finding London in terms of the arts?
Well,
community, maybe.
Well, there's a strong community around me. I don't know whether I would call everyone artists that I'm working with. I work with very closely with a compostist at the moment, and gardeners and biologists and educators. And yeah, and I do have a lot of friends who are musicians and poets and painters and all of that. So yeah, it's a very diverse place to be working, which is why I'm here, why I didn't leave. Originally, I wasn't planning on staying in London for very long. But it's one of these cities that holds space for so many practices to engage with each other. And so, yeah, I find myself keep to return over and over again. I keep thinking that I want to leave, but, yeah, I have a beautiful home and studio in East London. And, yeah, and it's been my base for about 11 years. But I travel a lot, and the last 4 months I haven't been in London very often. I just got back about a week and a half ago. So, yeah, I'm just arriving.
Well, welcome back then, and let's jump into your studio. What's happening? What are you working on? I mean, I want to hear about all those people you're working with, but what are you working on at the moment?
Well, I've just come out of two performances where it was mainly dance orientated, and now I'm focused on a new installation. I guess as a stepping stone from the last exhibition that I had about 4 or 5 months ago in London, in Regent's Place, Central London. And what I did there was built an installation kind of mirroring the architectural structure of a Japanese tea ceremony room. And all the materials that I chose to use were regenerative or soil renewing. So the idea of that whole installation or that stage that I built, because there was a series of dance performances that took place on it, were within the aftermath, the after stages of the exhibition, that all the materials could be donated or applied to the earth, to the soil, and would help support the levels of toxicity that are happening in the urban environment and so on. Yeah. So anyhow, leading up to
go on. I want to talk more about that, but go on. Leading up to what?
Yeah. So what I'm doing now is another stage. I'm building towards another installation for May. That's the next thing. There's a few other things that are happening, but this is my main focus of research, looking at specific materials and dances that move with these materials.
And so, the next stage, the next project, will it be another tea room or something else entirely?
It'll be completely different, but it'll be another regenerative stage. And it'll be at the Cornet Theatre in Notting Hill. And so that'll be, I guess, you know, but the way things work, usually I think there's something in 6 months, and then in a month another thing will pop up. And, yeah, and, you know, with dance, my dance practice is very fluid. I tend to go and you know, potentially I'll be dancing tomorrow night in front of an audience. So who knows? You know, it's just dance is always happening. So, yeah, but that's the next regenerative stage process I'm building.
So I want to talk more about the tea house, because it's such a beautiful tradition, the tea house, and that's kind of a wonderful way to discuss it in contemporary context. But I want to ask you first about your fluid dance practice. You may be dancing tomorrow night in front of a large group of people. What does that mean to you? How would that happen?
Well, a musician that I work with. Well, she actually is an activist for the Amazon, and I've been working very closely with her for the past 5 years, and she holds ceremonies and with song and smoke and plant and, you know, elemental goodness. And so she's performing at a venue called Cafe Otto, a music venue in East London, tomorrow night. So I'm building her a mandala out of materials, very specific materials for the stage. And it's just inevitable I'll be dancing, and whether or not I'll be visibly dancing, we don't know yet, but I'll be there getting ready with her, and we'll see what happens. Yeah. But it's still
so tomorrow. If you're dancing, you know, it'll be a kind of improvisational dance. It'll be kind of a type of conversation with her. How do you imagine?
Well, there are specific dances that are joined with certain songs that she's singing. Like there's one song that she sings, and traditionally the village of the Yawanawa peoples in the Amazon, they get together and they do the serpent dance. And so I have a feeling she's going to get me to do that tomorrow tonight. But it's like a community snake dance. And I've been meeting her a few times a year for the last 5 years now. And so I wouldn't call it improvisation as such. Actually, I don't know if I actually even believe in improvisation. I think there's always some mode of guidance or some sort of knowing, you know, that happens, even if you don't think you know what's going to happen.
Right, that's true.
But, yeah.
So tell me about the tea house. I'd love to know how that started, and then talk about the building of it and the materials a little bit, because it's such
have
a
you
project,
done a tea ceremony before? Have you been to Japan and
I have been to a tea ceremony. There was a guy in New York, Pierre Cernay, who built a tea house on the top of his apartment building, and he'd been, and still is, I think, learning. I mean, this is my knowledge of it, learning about how to do a tea ceremony for years. Mm-hmm. And apparently it's, you know, incredibly complex. And, he had the little cookies and the whole thing, and everything was just perfect.
Wow.
And how you hold the cup and all of that. So I learned a bit about, that. And the only other experience I have with it was a book by a Japanese writer called The Book of Tea. And it was just a gorgeous, gorgeous little book about the tea ceremony and how it wasn't nearly what this other guy was talking about as being, you know, so fraught with like all this formalism, but it was beautiful writing about the process.
That's extremely specific. I've only studied it for 1 year of my life, and that was just, I felt like I was learning how to take the first step into the room. Because walking is also very important. And for me, that the whole formality and the ritual of that is a dance, because the body, the one who's serving, who's holding the space, has, you know, very symbolic hand gestures and how the feet are positioned and how low you go into your knees and how you maneuver around the architecture of the space as well. So it's just a beautiful thing about Japanese arts, and I guess a lot of ancient arts as well, is that they embody all forms of mediums within one space, you know? Like almost like theater, I guess, the origin of theater. But there's painting and there's ceramics and there's dance and there's sound, you know, and there's the art of eating and drinking. And, but how I started with the tea ceremony space, this is the first time I've actually incorporated it so much. It's always come out a little bit in like dance and I guess the materiality of some of my sculptures and installations, but Rikyu, the man who, I guess, developed the tea ceremony in Japan. Oh gosh, when was he around? In like 1500s, I want to say. But I read years ago in a book that he said there was a structure, but he encouraged his disciples or his students to break it down and make it their own. He was very much regarding it as like this creative practice that everybody could access and everybody could put their own experience into an altar. And that really resonated with me with building this last stage. And so that's exactly what I did. And so I stuck with the mathematics of the room, but then the base was three-year-old organic horse manure and, you know, representing the row or the center, the hearth was, I had built this incense burner and I was burning pine resin, smudging the space. So yeah, I was taking all the elements, but then abstracting them or making them my own, personalizing them, I guess. Mm-hmm.
And where was it built exactly?
In this like this big glass corporate building in the center of London. It was part of a commission from British Land who wanted a group of artists to comment on the urban environment and ecology and what's happening. And it was a bit kind of off-putting the first time I went in there because I was like, ooh, you know, just total like development land, you know, where there used to be these beautiful historical buildings and council estates. Now it's like these shiny glass offices, you know, you live in New York, you're around it all the time. I'm still always slightly bothered when that happens, when I see it happening. But it was really important to have that conversation in that space, you know, for all like the city workers and the people that don't have that conversation in their daily life. You know, I think people who are just immersed take it for granted that, you know, other people aren't aware maybe of climate change and, you know, soil toxicity and, you know, the crisis that's happening, the eco crisis. And so it became really crucial for me to do it in an environment like that. Yeah, and when, like, you know, my first response was, like, rejection, but I got over that quite quickly. And, so it was
So tell me a little bit more about there was the manure on the bottom, the three-year-old manure, and then, and you know, or go on with what you're about to say, but also I'm interested in how the structure was built because, of course, this is all commenting on everything you were just mentioning about and in global warming's effect on the environment and community.
Mm.
So how was that built so it could all go back into the land?
Well, I chose very specific materials. So in the past couple of years, I've been, you know, straying away from using resins and just unnecessary materials that I don't feel are vibrating in a certain way or that are doing any good anymore for our planet, you know? And so a lot of it was done with this compostist, Harry Biles, that I'm working with. They're tending to a local nature reserve in Bethnal Green in the area that I live with. And so we've been developing a lot of projects and researching together, and the two of us have, you know, gone in quite in depth and looked at soil renewing recipes. And so on part of the installation, there was a low table and on it was 108 orbs. And they all had different recipes of proposals of things that people could do to the earth and different, you know, things like bat poo, and there were some seed bombs in there, and there was algae as like a substance to hold all these orbs together. And it was like a proposal of a recipe table of different methods that people could engage with. There was also a map describing all of it. But all the wood that I chose to use was tarred, which then will be turned into biochar, which is an Amazonian fertilizer, a natural fertilizer from the Amazon, which, you know, traps carbon. So there's everything was made within that vein of.
And then after it was built in this kind of unusual glass space too, would people come into it and have tea there? Was there a ceremony as well?
Oh, no. Well, there were two performances that were done for audiences, but nobody went in. But I actually, encourage people to go in, but I think, because it's like this shiny gallery structure and people found it a bit dirty, I think, even though it was like much more clean than anything else. It was like very, very clean horse shit, like top of the line manure. So, but I think people were slightly, repulsed, but there was a lot of scent going on too, because I was also working with a woman named Aurora Irving, and she and I made these orb structures at the beginning of the gate of the tea ceremony. I wish I had my images up on the website so you could have seen this. It might be a bit hard for you to understand, but they'll go up at some point. So we made these orbs, but they were a fox enfilade. So we actually found a dead fox nearby my studio, and we removed some of its parts and we made we're making perfumes from it. So we're extracting scents from urban animals at the moment. And so people were there was a bit of a foxy stench going on as well, which I personally love, but a lot of people find it a bit off-putting. So it wasn't the most encouraging environment for them to go in, but yeah, they were.
Right, I love
that. If I ever put it up again, then I really want to push them to go in there. Yeah.
So I'm glad you explained that. And this whole project then was taken down and moved. You're working on others, I know, but to step back a little bit to the way you work. This isn't most of your work, it seems, including the tea house that we've just discussed, isn't easy to collect or own, which is, I would think, part of the message of it, if that's correct what I'm saying. So how does the work get supported? I know you go to residencies and there's grants and fellowships, but is that primarily what supports the work, or is there work that can be collected?
There are. I do. I make ceramics and glass objects as well, and I do sell those occasionally. Some of them aren't for sale because they're at the moment I kind of need them, so I just have them within my space. But yeah, I do make ceramics and glass pieces, and I also paint sometimes and do drawings. Mainly it's commissions. I work on commissions and. And it's working for me. Managing.
Okay,
I
want to ask you then about that one thing you just said. When you talk about the ceramics you've done, and I've seen some of the, it's raku, it's stoneware, porcelain, different things. You said some of them you're keeping for yourself. They almost look like sort of. Ritualistic objects. What do you mean by keeping them for yourself? What does that mean? Why is that important?
Well, exactly for that reason, because I need them for the rituals. There are a lot of them that I make. I use them on a regular basis for ceremonies, for dance pieces. But they're power objects for me. My firing process with the ceramics specifically. I don't use chemical glazes. I do a process called sagar, which I collect like crow feathers. My parents live in Medicine Hat, Alberta, and so my dad sends me bison hair from the wild bison in the prairies, or if I'm there, I collect it. And, I use Himalayan salts and sage and seaweed collected from Japan. Had some, holy cow dung from India. So I use all these materials that I collect that are quite personal for my journeys, and then offer them to the fire, and that's what creates the effects on the clay. So there's a lot of story within I almost see it as like it's a collaboration with the materials and those landscapes and then the fire, you know, and I make offerings to the fire with the clay and the shapes, and I let the fire do the painting on the surface. And as you can see, what comes out with Sagar is absolutely unbelievable. It's just like magentas and yellow ochres, and you know, sometimes I get flashes of blue by chance, and but there's like a high level of breakage, so I've been really understanding like impermanence through my ceramic practice,
right.
Cause a lot of it breaks because it's a very precarious method, because you have to
that are carrying all this kind of emotional or psychological or ritualistic kind of weight, it would seem also that those are hard to let go of or let other people possess, because that sounds enormously personal. I mean, I suppose that could be a commission too, right? Or would the ceramics not work that way? Like, could other people have them? That seems like it would be almost a part of yourself. It's a ritualistic object that's not meant to be possessed.
Yeah, and people do have them, but I actually choose who has them. Like, I'm not with the gallery, and I'm not really in that the market of the arts. And never have I really been interested in that way of working, producing to sell. That's not really my intention of making these. But it happens, and you know, I've said no as well to people, but certain people do have my pieces. Yeah, because the glasswork that I do as well is right now I'm making like these gourd-like shapes, and within them I'm collecting water from around the world, from like kind of sacred, I guess sacred sources to me. All water is sacred, but I have some from like a holy well in the Middle Atlas of Morocco, and a temple in Japan. So they're containing these water bodies as well, and so they become very precious to me personally. So those sorts of things, they're not for sale.
Well, that's beautiful and very exciting. So before I ask you the last question, is there anything else you want to say that I should have asked you? There'll be, of course, links to things and images in this interview so people can find out more information. But is there anything else you want to say about your work or to the audience?
Keep taking care of the planet, you know? And, you know, that's all. Keep our awareness up and, you know, periphery open. And, we have to take care right now. Our ethics of the land need to expand. And, you know, there's no such thing as sustainability anymore. We need to, like, regenerate. We need to do, like, 10 times more work to support nature at this point in time, you know? So, I think you understand that.
I do. And hopefully everyone listening does. Nisa, what are you reading now? I'm always curious what people are reading.
Through my stack, I'm constantly going through, like, kind of shifting. I have, like, a rota of books. But right now I'm reading Tantric Visions, Divine Feminine, by David Kingsley. I actually got it in Mumbai about 4 years ago, and I just loved the cover. It's this really beautiful cover of Kalima, you know, slicing people's heads off, different gods. I never really kind of sat down, and so recently I've been going through it and reading the myths, the goddesses. That's one book that's close to me right now on my travels. I've recently been in Sweden at a house that has probably one of the most incredible book collections I've ever experienced. It's at Don and Moki Cherry's house, and there I found a book called Mudra, and it's based on all the Japanese Buddhist sculptures and their hand gestures and the dance of their hands. So I was really investing time into that one book. I also have Silent Spring by Rachel Carson, one of the first kind of, maybe the first eco-feminists of our time. Well, yeah, you know, she pointed herself as that, I guess, in the 60s. So that's kind of it. These three books are really fueling me right now at the moment.
Nita, I want to thank you so much for talking with me today. It's really been a pleasure. I wish you great success in your next
Brainerd,
project.
Thank you so much for inviting me to speak with you today.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.